Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Wednesday, February 1st, 2017. Yes, there are two R's in February. And I want to relieve any concerns you may have. This is the place where you can escape Super Bowl hype. I don't care about it. I won't be watching. We're going to the ballet for a matinee Sunday afternoon. Because there are so many more important things going on. Yesterday, Donald Trump, in kind of a game show mode, invited two men to the White House, both judges on federal courts. And we don't know what happened to the guy from Pennsylvania. He went out the side door because Trump picked Neil Gorsuch from Colorado. And while Trump was acting a little more presidential, it's only by degree, because he insisted on inserting himself into this nominee and how he's honoring his promises to the voters and blah, blah, blah. And along the way, he decried the lack of, bipartisan comity in Washington today. He said that the judge deserves to be confirmed unanimously. But Trump ignores the divisive way that he ran for president, the divisions that he exploited to become the 45th president in a very questionable manner, as you know. And so he continues to play a victim, act as if the media is against him, the Democrats are enemies. And so this is going to be a contentious process. And it's interesting to me because, as you know, I'm older than some of my listeners. I'm 63. And I first started behind the microphone hosting radio talk shows when Richard Nixon was still president. And I survived the Reagan years. And the Reagan years is where I developed this term, this label, for cabinet officers who are opposed to the mission of the agency that they have been named to run. I call it the wrecking crew. And Trump has assembled his own wrecking crew. Virtually all of his nominees are people who are really devoted to dismantling, if not completely neutralizing, most of the work of the agencies that they're going to run. So Neil Gorsuch, when I heard that name, I Googled Neil Gorsuch and Ann Gorsuch. Ann Gorsuch turns out to be Neil's mom. And she served for 2 years during the Reagan administration, 81 to 83, as the administrator of the EPA. And during her watch, she blocked the deployment of Superfund monies to clean up toxic waste sites. She reduced enforcement of the existing EPA regulations. And this was a relatively new agency. It had started under Nixon. Yes, Richard Nixon was the guy who created the Environmental Protection Agency. And so with lineage like that, Judge Gorsuch is the spawn of a member of Reagan's wrecking crew. And it shows just how incestuous the Republican leadership has become. You must have some sort of lineage to Reagan or the Bushes or other Republican stalwarts of the past. And this guy has a terrible record on the bench. Now, he claims to be an originalist, which means that he only reads the words of the original Constitution, ignores the legislative intent of laws that are passed. And so, in that respect, he is like Antonin Scalia. But in a continuum, from left to right, that the New York Times published today, they place Judge Gorsuch well to the right of Antonin Scalia, along down there on the far, 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 far right, occupied by the silent jurist, Clarence Thomas. Now, the case that Judge Gorsuch was one of the appeals court members, and they sent it up to the Supreme Court, which ruled in favor of it, was the Hobby Lobby case. And this is a really offensive and pernicious use of both corporate personhood and phony claims of religious freedom and infringement on religious freedom. Hobby Lobby is a company that has stores across the country, thousands of employees. Before Obamacare, they provided contraceptive coverage in the insurance policies that they gave to their employees. But after Obamacare, they had some sudden religious awakening, and they declared that their corporation is religious to the extent that it could not participate in Obamacare coverage that provided contraception for women. And so Hobby Lobby hired lawyers, and they sued to avoid having to fall into the clutches of Obamacare. And all they had to do to opt out was to sign a form and submit it to the government. And in a separate case brought by the Little Sisters of the Poor, a cynical effort by the Roman Catholic bishops here in this country, they claimed that their religious rights would be violated simply by signing a form to opt out of contraceptive coverage. Now, a religious organization, I think, is very different from a corporation that's owned by a family. And once you embrace the corporate model, you lose the ability to imprint your own values on that operation. You either get the benefit of corporate coverage, which allows you to limit your liability for losses, or you don't. But the Supreme Court ruled in the Hobby Lobby case that was punted up to it by Judge Gorsuch and his companions on the circuit court there, the appeals court in Denver. And it is now a precedent that stands. Now, interestingly, Judge Gorsuch has never publicly ruled on issues related to abortion. And that's a favorite pattern now for nominees to the court from either party, so that they can simply say, I can't answer that, Senator, because it may come before the court in the future, and there's absolutely no record of where he stands. Now, he wrote a book opposing assisted suicide and euthanasia. And so you can infer from that he would be opposed to the right of a woman to choose an abortion. But we don't know. And while you can expect senators to try to wriggle an answer out of him, it's standard practice to just dodge that, and effectively so. Will the Democrats be able to block the confirmation of Neil Gorsuch to the court? He's 49 years old, so he, if confirmed, will be there for 30 or 40 years. And if history is any guide, the Democrats did attempt to launch a filibuster against Sam Alito's confirmation. That was about 2006. But it didn't get very far because there weren't enough Democrats to sustain it. And under the current rules, the Democrats, who have a total of 48 in their head count, two of those are independents, Sanders of Vermont and King of Maine. Sanders is likely to oppose the confirmation. I don't know about Angus King. But the Democrats need 41 votes to continue a filibuster to block this confirmation. And already 6 Democratic senators have announced that they're going to confirm this guy, which means that virtually every other Democrat has to support Jeff Merkley of Oregon's plan for a filibuster. The odds aren't very good on this case, friends. And I hope the Democrats can find a way to block this confirmation. And there's a little bit of unity showing up in today's Judiciary Committee vote, which has approved at the committee level the nomination of Jeff Sessions, a dangerous radical conservative, as the Attorney General. And Sessions, of course, the Alabama senator, can expect most Republicans to toe the line and vote for him on the floor. So it was a straight party line vote at the committee, 11 Republicans for him and 9 Democrats opposed. But this is the first time we've seen the Democrats really hang together and oppose one of these dangerous nominations. Will this extend to the Supreme Court nominee? I doubt it, but we can hope. And there was a little tussle at the Judiciary Committee as Al Franken, the former comic and radio host, was challenging Jeff Sessions' civil rights record and claimed that Ted Cruz, the Republican from Texas, had misrepresented that record. And then the chair, John Cornyn, rushed to his defense. He cut Franken off. And Franken pressed on, saying, well, he disparaged me. And the fact that he's not here isn't my fault. Anyway, they just kind of talked past each other, and Franken went on in that little tirade. This one gives me whiplash. Last night on the PBS NewsHour, Neil Katyal, a man I've interviewed a few times in the past and who served as the acting Solicitor General in the Obama administration, he touts himself as a liberal or progressive, he took the position opposing Trump's travel ban on the PBS NewsHour last night. And I did a double take because the opposing view was presented by George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley. And Turley, who made it clear he doesn't like the travel ban personally, made the case that the president has pretty broad authority under the law to make these immigration policies, and that the courts and the Congress may be unable to really do much about that. So to his credit, Katyal was pretty strong in opposing the travel ban and advancing good legal arguments against it. And then I look at the New York Times today and an op-ed from Neil K. Katyal. Why liberals should back Neil Gorsuch? Huh? Whoa, give me my neck brace. Give me some OxyContin. Man, that hurt. You can read it for yourself. It's one of those bipartisan feel-good arguments that Gorsuch would help to restore confidence in the rule of law. Well, that's conservative code, Neil. I don't buy it. Over at BuzzFeed, they got a hold of the State Department memo that's been shipped out to the embassies worldwide, trying to explain Donald Trump's travel ban in the executive order issued on January 27th. And it's interesting because the language is not nearly as vitriolic as the executive order was. And it quietly walks back some of the most egregious elements of the poorly drafted, poorly vetted executive order. So, in the State Department memo, this executive order does not restrict the travel of dual nationals so long as they hold the passport of an unrestricted country and possess a valid U.S. visa. They may resume travel to the United States. In the next paragraph, it says that these same dual passport holders, that if they have a visa and they have a passport from an unrestricted country, even if they hold dual nationality from one of the restricted countries, they may enter. And they also clarify that green card holders are allowed in. But the refugee program is firmly suspended for at least 4 months, and it's not clear if that will be extended. And it's just interesting to see how this is being quietly refined, even as the bluster from the White House asserts that, no, we got no apologies. This is what we need to do to keep America safe. And it's, of course, really bizarre, as I very clearly argued yesterday, there is no rational basis for these massive travel bans aimed broadly at countries and members of certain religious groups. And a CNN editor who holds a green card and he's had it for 3 or 4 years now, he is an editor named Mohammed Tawfiq, an Iraqi citizen. He was in Iraq on assignment for CNN as a manager of their international desk. And when he flew into the Atlanta Hartsfield Airport on Sunday, he was held for at least an hour after the Department of Homeland Security said, we're not sure we can let you in on a green card. That was at least an hour after the clarifying memo had been issued that, yes, green card holders were not subject to the ban. So he is now suing the government and the Department of Homeland Security, and I hope his case brings some clarity and some relief. Now, it's interesting to see that here in California, the city of San Francisco, the county of Santa Clara, which is Silicon Valley and San Jose, they have filed lawsuits against the federal government preemptively over the threat by Trump to cut funds, federal funds, that flow to cities that have a sanctuary policy. Now, we've defined that sanctuary means that they don't round people up and deliver them for deportation unless they've been convicted of a serious crime. And this is intended to really aid the police in getting cooperation from non-citizens who live in our communities. So San Francisco gets $1.2 billion a year in federal funding, and Trump is threatening illegally to try to withhold that. Legally, I believe he can only withhold money related to immigration, not to housing or transportation, transit, those sorts of things. But he is likely to try, the bully that he is, to expand that power. And in Sacramento, the state legislature is thinking about passing a bill that would provide statewide sanctuary for immigrants by keeping local law enforcement from cooperating with federal immigration authorities. And that would make the entire state a sanctuary. And certainly that could lead to an attempt by Trump to cut off funding to the state of California. And Governor Jerry Brown has already threatened to withhold tax revenues flowing into the federal government from California. I think some of this is getting a little too far out front of any actual moves to threaten or sanction the sanctuary cities. But I think leaders believe that it is so likely that it's better to get the legal pipeline filled early. In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott, the Republican right-winger, has announced that he is going to cut off more than $1 million in state grant money to Travis County. Now, it's interesting, Austin is the state capital, and it is the county seat of Travis County. It's one of the few places I've been in Texas, and Austin is a beautiful town. I've had a great time there. Anyway, the new sheriff there, a woman who took office recently, Sally Hernandez, has announced a policy based on her campaign promises to end her department's blanket cooperation with immigration. And the public, she said, must be confident that local law enforcement is focused on local public safety, not federal immigration enforcement. But Abbott has followed through on a threat to cut off money, and it'll be very interesting to see how that plays out. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins podcast with your subscriptions. People like Kevin Beckley, Keith Hull, Pauline Nixon, one of my favorite Nixons, and John Ross just renewed, it looks like John just took out a new annual subscription. John, I better make a note to get in touch and see what bonus book you would like, but thank you for that new subscription. And if you're not already a subscriber, it's never too late. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click on the button that says menu, pull it down, click on become a subscriber, takes you to the sign-up page, and you've got options right there before your very eyes. Well, Trump has announced he wants to expedite the granting of an easement to allow the Dakota Access Pipeline to be built under the Missouri River in North Dakota. And the Secretary of the Army, acting Secretary of the Army, has directed the Corps of Engineers to proceed with the easement required. And while this sounds like a fast track, and we've got Senator John Hoeven here, a Republican, saying that this is an important step forward and, we're going to see this approved here. There are some interesting wrinkles because President Obama instructed the Corps of Engineers to conduct a full environmental impact statement review of this pipeline. And typically that takes years. And so the tribes will have good legal standing to delay the granting of an easement until the environmental impact report is completed. At least, that's how it used to work in this country, where we felt that there were laws and that we could have some predictability about the rule of law as it applies. The Republicans are getting restless again, and moves are afoot in both the House and the Senate to roll back the regulations that were announced by the Obama administration in the final 60 days. This is something that happens, and the issues that they're going to roll back, it's really sad to see. Number one, they want to lift the rules that limited the amount of methane that leaks from oil and gas extraction sites, including fracking wells. And this is a huge source of carbon in our atmosphere, We believe in some cases more methane escapes than the carbon that is burned when that fuel source is ultimately used. The other area that they want to roll back is a mountaintop mining rule that limited the use of explosives that just blow the lid off a mountain so that coal miners can access the coal that's underneath. It destroys the entire area and the streams in the surrounding vicinity. But that rule will be rolled back, most likely. And they also want to reopen our national parks to corporate resource exploitation. Over in Ukraine, fighting has resumed in the eastern area. At least 8 Ukrainian soldiers and 3 on the pro-Russian side have been killed in recent days. And this, I think, is a signal that Putin believes that he's got Trump where he wants him and that he can move with some impunity. And it's a complicated situation, as you know. I object to the U.S. involvement in the coup that brought Petro Poroshenko to power in Kiev. I accept the fact that Crimea is solidly Russian, and that's not going to be returned. And as to the fate of the Russian population in eastern Ukraine, I support self-determination. Now, at the same time, Russia has operated in a stealth manner with the troops that didn't have any insignia or tags that would indicate who they were fighting for. And so I'm not, overly sympathetic to Russia. And at the same time, the anti-Russian phobia that is rampant in the United States is deeply troubling as well. But my concern is that Trump will be played by Putin, and this could be the first test case. Meanwhile, Israel is accelerating its plans to construct more illegal settlements on Palestinian land. They've approved thousands more of housing units, another 3,000 on the West Bank, roughly doubling 2 earlier proposed construction plans. And those are the plans that brought the UN resolution that the United States finally abstained on in the final days of the Obama administration. But again, encouraged by their reading of Trump, the Netanyahu government is moving forward. Now, there are a couple of domestic issues that this is related to. One are the criminal and fraud investigations into Netanyahu himself. And the other is that Israel's dealing with the fallout from their plan to remove the unauthorized illegal settlement at Amona. And they're in the process of evacuating it right now. So this could be an effort to assuage the attitudes of many Israelis over the Amona settlement. So on top of that, while I took the day off on Monday, a story I missed that I caught up with last night is that Netanyahu has spoken up in favor of Trump's plan to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. This is a very risky, in fact, quite dangerous move. And I think that the bully tactics and the arrogance that are embedded in these actions, or at least these comments, could lead to a massive and widespread conflict in the Middle East. And I think that the combination of Trump and Netanyahu is so dangerous, so explosive, that these moves could be the triggers that detonate those metaphorical bombs. So Netanyahu says, I would like to clarify unequivocally that our view has always been and continues to be that the U.S. embassy should be here in Jerusalem. And he wanted to eliminate any doubts that there was, indecision in his cabinet on this issue. And gratuitously, he added that he is very enthusiastic about supporting Donald Trump's border wall with Mexico, saying that the Israeli model along its border with Egypt has proven successful. Note that he didn't mention the barriers, these huge walls that are built on Palestinian land that separate Palestinians from Palestinians. And few people seem to mention the walls that were built to ghettoize the Jews in Warsaw and elsewhere during the Holocaust. Fox News is finally retracted its erroneous tweet that the suspect in the mosque killing in Quebec City was a Moroccan Muslim. It took them almost 3 days to correct that obvious error. And as you may know, there was a man of Moroccan origin who's actually a hero. His name is, and he's a citizen of Quebec, Mohamed Belkadir. And he was held overnight in custody because he had been clearing snow off the steps of the mosque when he heard gunshots, and he went in to try to help people who'd been shot. And instead, he was rounded up as a suspect, and Fox News and the Trump White House ran with that, trying to make this out as an Islamic State or a jihadi event. When in fact, this the actual suspect, whose name is Bissonnette, is a Canadian white nationalist who reveres Donald Trump and Marine Le Pen, the French nationalist. I don't really need to comment on this. Greg Phillips, the man who is the sole source for Donald Trump's false claims that there was massive election fraud, voter fraud, that is, in the past presidential race. Well, Greg Phillips bases his claim on the number of people who are registered in more than one state and people who he says are dead, who are on the voter rolls. And he falsely infers that because there are registrations, that means there are illegal votes. Well, it turns out Greg Phillips is registered to vote in Alabama, Texas, and Mississippi. I didn't make that up. You don't have to. You know, we talked yesterday about Trump's efforts to beef up our cyber warfare capabilities, cyber defense, and a story from the Associated Press today reveals that one of the contractors employed by the Air Force in Florida to run a social media patrol operation called WebOps, well, it is so beset with incompetence, cronyism, and flawed data that most people involved with it say that it's having very little impact. Several current and former employees say that they don't have Arabic specialists, and they attempt to go online and troll these people, but their Arabic is so bad that it's obvious that they're not real people. Four current or former workers have said they personally witnessed WebOps data being manipulated to create the appearance of success. Like a Star Wars test, huh? Missile defense? The Attorney General of New York, Eric Schneiderman, has sued Time Warner Cable. And this is a pet peeve of mine. Time Warner sold internet service to people, promising very fast internet speeds. But in fact, what they deliver is 70 to 80% below what they promise. And one of the reasons I moved to a new location last November is that I was getting my internet service from AT&T on a DSL system. I even paid a premium rate to get faster uploads and downloads, and then discovered that those rates, those speeds, were not technically available due to infrastructure limitations in my area. I did get a fat refund from AT&T, and then I dumped them. Couple of items to wrap up with about the Roman Catholic Church. Here in San Francisco, the Archbishop Salvatore Cordileone is a very conservative guy. And apparently he believes that San Francisco's model single-payer health care system is something that he doesn't want to share with the people who work for the Archdiocese. So after a 4-year legal struggle, the Archdiocese has been ordered to pay the city about $3 million. Because it kept playing games on reporting how many employees it actually had. And at one point, they reported that they had 1,722 people who were qualified for health coverage in San Francisco, but they had only made payments for about a third of those. And finally, a positive item about the Roman Catholic Church. I'm opposed to the death penalty, and it's one of the points of agreement I have with Catholics. There is a priest who died in Florida. His name was Father Rene Robert, and he had devoted his life to working with troubled people. And as a result, without knowing what his future held, about 20 years ago, he signed and had notarized a statement that read, I request that the person found guilty of homicide for my killing not be subject to or put in jeopardy of the death penalty under any circumstances, no matter how heinous their crime or how much I may have suffered. Now, this is quite an advance directive. It's very unusual. And it turns out that it was prescient, because Father Robert was shot multiple times by Stephen Murray, a repeat offender that Father Robert had been trying to help. And the shooter led police to the discovery of his body. And now, despite the advance directive that Father Robert left, the district attorney has announced that he is seeking the death penalty as he brings the suspect to trial. I'm Peter B. Collins. Thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.